It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Trump's abrupt decision to change course on his sweeping reciprocal tariff plan has created economic uncertainty for Wisconsinites. Our state exported more than $27 billion internationally last year.
With global trade decisions changing day by day, we're checking in with Wisconsin's congressional delegation about how to navigate this volatility.
I spoke with Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson yesterday, and I asked him if he thought Trump's tariff strategy will be effective.
Well, I hope so. We'll see how it all turns out. He obviously has a strategy in mind. I'm not privy to what that strategy is, and I understand that as well. If you're negotiating with people, you can't let them know what your strategy is either. So the more people that know, the more that might get out. So I don't know what the end game is here. I was, relieved when he paused the very high reciprocal tariffs that were going to create an awful lot of pain for Wisconsinites, for our manufacturers, for our farmers. So I'm glad he paused that, is focusing now on really the real abuser of the World Trading Organization and international trading norms is China. And that's a tough nut to crack. That's a difficult problem to solve.
You've been critical of unfair trade practices you see in China. That's the world's second largest economy. As you see Trump raising the tariff on Chinese imports to 125%, do you think an escalating trade war with China can ultimately lead to more fair trade?
I hope so. I'm hoping, and I'm cheering President Trump on that he succeeds. I don't want to see him fail at this. From my standpoint, the primary issue with China is how they have stolen and continue to steal our intellectual property. It's not just the big stuff. But I mean, even small companies that have some kind of technological advantage, China has no problem coming in, ripping off their intellectual property, stealing their products or, producing them, ignoring their patents and, literally bankrupting good businesses. So that is the main abuse. But again, through their central planning, they focus on particular industries. For example, the steel industry produced gross amounts of overcapacity, which really threatened the economic viability of steel mills around the world. So it's a very difficult issue to deal with.
So you would see the U.S. benefiting here with an escalating trade war with China?
Well, I hope we benefit from this. I hope it doesn't blow up in our faces. I think the initial reaction of the markets kind of mimicked my own concern. They obviously bounced back yesterday when he paused his retaliatory tariffs. But last time I looked, they're down again today because of the just level of uncertainty. I come from the private sector. I think the one thing that's required for investment and economic progress is a stable situation. Businesses like certainty. They do not like uncertainty. That's when they start holding on to their investment capital and stop growing their businesses. So the sooner this can conclude, the sooner that the entire strategy plays out and we end up with whatever the result will be, the better.
You worked in the plastics manufacturing industry in Wisconsin for decades before Congress. How do you think companies like the one you ran are feeling about this economic volatility? And does it make sense to try to reshore manufacturing? Is that plausible?
Well, there's no doubt that there are a number of products that are vital to our national security interests that have offshored. We need to figure out some way to bring them back. I mean, pharmaceuticals, precursor chemicals, the active pharmaceutical ingredients, advanced semiconductors, rare earth minerals. I mean, there's actually, I think, probably a really significant list of those things. But we ought to target those products as opposed to just generalized tariffs and, erecting our own trade barriers, because it makes no sense to try and bring back high labor content product. That's why it moved offshore to begin with. It makes a lot of sense to diversify our supply base. It doesn't make any sense to have all of it manufactured in China, and that's now been happening. And I'm talking to businesses who have made the investments outside of China into places like Vietnam, who then are, you know, on the back of their heels, all of a sudden with these, you know, massive tariffs being announced for some of the countries they've moved production to. So again, they responded to the earlier trade initiatives from the first Trump administration, and now there's the backlash, and they're going to potentially pay another price for having done what I think we were trying to get them to do to begin with, is at least move away from China so we didn't put all our eggs in one basket there. And again, I think one of the biggest problems we have in America is we don't have enough workers. Now, there's multiple reasons for that. We tell all of our kids they've got to get a four-year degree, so we imply that the factory work is beneath you. It's not. All work has value. We have a completely broken legal immigration system because, you know, we threw open our borders and have this mass inward migration of illegal immigration. So, again, there's a number of things, you know, causing that problem, but we pay people not to work. You know, we have an overly generous welfare system. So, you know, we have to address our worker shortage as well.
Senator, I want to get back to something you said at the outset about you not knowing the end game. Should it be up to the sole discretion of the president to have this much tariff authority?
Well, Congress has given him that authority. I think Congress, in a number of instances, has willingly granted the executive branch an awful lot of their constitutional authority because they don't want to be held accountable. If I had more confidence in Congress, I might be a little bit more aggressive in trying to claw that authority back. But you know, when we can't pass budgets, when we don't pass appropriation bills, when we don't, you know, take our power of the purse seriously, it's kind of hard to want to claw that back as well. So I think theoretically, yeah, I'd like to see Congress exercise more of its constitutional authority, give less of it away, claw some of it back. But in the current situation, that's not going to happen anytime soon. So all I can really do is make this administration aware of the collateral damage done by the trade war and, you know, hope that, you know, they're sensitive to that and can ameliorate it as best as possible.
But with that said, a group of senators have introduced a bipartisan bill to rein in presidential power and tariffs, as introduced by your colleague Chuck Grassley of Iowa. Do you support it?
We'll see exactly if it ever gets brought up on the floor. But right now, I can say it doesn't have a chance of passage.
Why not?
Because it simply doesn't. I mean, I think the House just instituted in their rules a way to prevent that from happening. So, again, that's, you know, I'm big into reality. So the reality situation is you're not going to be able to claw back that constitutional authority anytime soon. So, like I said, my role is to just make sure the administration understands the reality of the situation, the collateral damage the trade war is doing.
Do you feel like the Trump administration has been receptive to pushback from you and other Republicans about these tariffs and the concerns you have?
I think the fact that the president paused the reciprocal tariffs is evidence of that fact. I know the U.S. Trade Representative Greer, we're in contact with him. I'll be meeting with him in the next few weeks. He certainly got the case studies I gave him and entered into the record during our Finance Committee hearing with him. So, no, they're definitely open to the dialogue and communication.
We know tariffs are raised, consumers, Wisconsinites pay more. As you mentioned, companies have higher costs up and down their long supply chains. How long should Wisconsinites be prepared to wait for positive effects to kick in?
Well, again, it's one of the reasons I'm not in favor of tariffs as a revenue raiser. I don't want to tax the American people more. I don't want to drive up the cost of any products. I want to reduce the size, scope, and cost of the federal government. So I'm focusing on returning to a reasonable pre-pandemic level of spending. That's kind of what my focus is on right now, not raising more revenue through tariffs or increasing tax rates on anybody.
In terms of that pre-pandemic level of spending, we see the House passing the Senate-adopted budget framework, GOP leaders planning to extend the 2017 Trump tax cuts. Reducing the national debt, that's been a major priority for you. Will you vote for a potential tax cut that is not paid for with deficit reduction measures?
First of all, we're not cutting anybody's taxes. We're just not increasing them. So we need to prevent a massive automatic tax increase on every American taxpayer. So that's what we're trying to do. Nobody's talking about cutting taxes for the wealthy. It's just trying to prevent a massive, in excess of $4 trillion tax increase. And no, I'm going to fight hard to make sure that we have a reduction in the spending level to a reasonable pre-pandemic level. There's nobody can justify going from $4.4 trillion of total government spending in 2019 to over $7 trillion this year. It's completely unjustified. A reasonable pre-pandemic, I've laid out a number of options, somewhere between $5.5 and $6.5 trillion without touching Social Security or Medicare or current interest. So it's entirely possible. It's eminently reasonable. And that's what I'm working on and fighting for.
So you think that Americans who are in the lowest brackets, tax brackets, and are dependent on some government programs, that they're going to be okay?
Well, I want to make sure that they don't get an automatic tax increase. And all I'm talking about is probably the one we'll center on is 2019 spending. I don't think we were spending too little in 2019. You know, spending what we are going to spend on Social Security and Medicare and interest, but spending what we spent in 2019 completely increased for population growth and inflation. Like I say, eminently reasonable. I don't think anybody would be harmed in that process at all. And the benefit would be we hopefully will avoid a major debt crisis because the spending level and these deficits are completely unsustainable.
Senator Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Have a great day.
Ron Johnson is a Republican U.S. Senator from Wisconsin with us to share his thoughts on the Trump administration's use of tariffs and the economic uncertainty they have produced. We spoke yesterday.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, visit two projects in western Wisconsin that protect soil quality with hands-on research and public involvement.
Bring your shovel, put it in the soil, tip it over, listen to the soils, smell the soils, feel the soils.
Dig into the conversation coming up here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Weekly crop reports are back up and running from the National Agricultural Statistics Service.
With the growing season on the horizon, soil health is top of mind for Wisconsin farmers. And today we're digging into agricultural sustainability with a look at two soil health projects in western Wisconsin.
In-ground probes across Vernon County farms are tracking soil temperature and moisture as we speak. But first, we're headed to Grant County in southwestern Wisconsin, where a new farmer-led learning center is taking soil care practices to a new level. Joining us now from Fields of Sinsinawa is soil advisor Rick Bieber. Rick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having us, Rob.
Before we get into the soil, I want to hear about the fields. The fields of Sinsinawa, a very unique history, a unique landscape here. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
The history behind it, it's the convent of the Dominican Sisters have a landscape there of not quite 500 acres that the Dominican Sisters have always been known for their teachings or helping educate the world. That community is going down in population. So the wisdom of the remaining sisters have been that they would like their legacy to still be in teaching, but they're asking the landscape to be the classroom now. So they've asked the Fields of Sinsinawa if we could make that into a demonstration farm that would be demonstrating the pillars of soil care that are known in the regenerative world as bringing things back to soil health.
What brought you in as soil advisor to the Fields of Sinsinawa? What made you want to make that trek to southwestern Wisconsin?
I'm from northern South Dakota. I retired off my farm there, and a lot of these practices that are known in regenerative agriculture we've been doing on our farm there in South Dakota for 30, 35 years already. So we have a lot of experience with that. But what drew me to the fields of Sinsinawa is Dave Brandt was kind of the godfather of regenerative agriculture, so to speak. And it was somewhat his idea or his dream to have a training center of some sort. And Dave was a good friend of mine, along with a lot of other good friends of Dave, got together and decided they wanted to start this farmer-led, farmer-implemented, and farmer-advised learning center. So what brought me here was their unique topography. The landscape lies with the elevation of the mound, they call it. It's elevation rise of about 300 feet compared to the lower elevation, and it's covered with trees. So we have a bit of forest we look at. But coming off that, we have our watersheds coming off there. And the fields of Sinsinawa, the Dominican Sisters, have three distinct watersheds in varying lengths, but a couple of them have quite a length to them, to where we can actually monitor the water from when God gives it to us until it leaves our landscape. And many research farms around the world do not have that. They have to deal with somebody else's watershed. So that was one of the things that drew me, is that we can monitor the water and we can go ahead and start using our soil care practices to see once if we can't draw more carbon into the soil. And the higher the carbon levels go, the better the water quality should get.
Let's dig into that soil now. Rick, you're doing a lot of measuring and testing and things like that. The lesson I'm taking here is soil is more complicated than I would think to look at it. What's going on in it?
Well, I don't know if it's so complicated, Rob. I think it's complex. And there is a difference there. Complex is a bunch of systems that are put together. And if we look at the systems as a system holistically, we can figure out what makes our water purer, what makes our food better, and all these things. So what we're trying to do here, and we actually just started a program that's quite unique to our organization as far as nobody else around the world is really doing this, is we're benchmarking all of the nutrients in the soil that are inherent to the properties of the soil. So we're measuring the total carbons and the total nitrogens and total phosphorus and all of the 18 essential nutrients for life. We're measuring them in the soils and then and monitoring also. But along with that, we're measuring the life in the soils to find out where the communities are at, to see if the balances are there, because every community has to have a balance for it to function properly and for life to sustain itself without a lot of excess inputs.
On a practical level, what does that process look like? What are you doing in the ground? How often are you testing? How wide an area are you covering?
Well, we've reached out, the field of Sinsinawa has reached out to the watersheds of Wisconsin. There's about 50 organized watersheds, and we've reached out to all them and asked if they want to join in our program, so that they can find the soils that are in their watershed rather than us trying to pick when we don't know their watersheds. So they get to pick what soils they want to use, what farmers they want to use, and then they'll do a total nutrient digestion test. They'll do a PLFA, that's a phospholipid fatty acid test. That tells us what the differentiations are in the soil. And then in the regenerative world, there's a test called the Haney soil test or soil health test. And we're doing that one also. And that one there, the farmers can use immediately to figure out where their nutrient needs are for this year's crop. And the other ones are more benchmarking to see once how the practices of the farm or the landscape, either the previous practices or practices going forward, can affect the total nutrients and or the biological communities.
Doing these things, I understand, can help soil health, can protect water quality. If a farmer is taking these measurements and then taking them into account as they plant and fertilize and things like that, is that something that's going to help them with things like input costs?
We would hope so. We've seen this in many places throughout the world where once all these communities are balanced, the nutritional needs from the outside nutrition, whether it be additional manure or whether it be synthetic inputs of some sort, those can either be lowered and or reduced. We have to understand that we have been farming our land in a style for many, many decades already, if not centuries, that have been a bit disruptive to the community below the soil. But as we repair that community or allow that community to repair itself, which it does, it's a self-governing system down there. If we allow that to happen, now the dependence upon outside resources to grow the crop diminishes drastically.
What kind of farming techniques can break some of those cycles you were talking about and help preserve soil quality for the long run?
There's five that are pretty much recognized throughout agriculture, and one of them is soil armor, just having something on the soil surface. To it can be a living plant, or it can be the residue from the previous plants of whatever they are. And what that does is protect the soil from the intensity of the sunlight, because the sunlight can cause spikes in temperature and dives in temperature at night. And we don't want to have that happen to the extremes that it does in today's agriculture. Another pillar is to have living diversity out there at all times, more than just one plant or one system of roots there. Today's farmers, and I was one of them, that would plant a wheat and then it would be just wheat, or it'd just be corn or soybeans or sunflowers or whatever you do, wherever you farm around the world. And that particular plant only is alive for 3 months or 5 months, or maybe it's 8 months or something like that. But the biological creatures below ground have to live off a carbon molecule whenever they want to move their food sources, carbon molecule. And if it's not being sequestered from the atmosphere through a plant into the soil, now it has to be eaten out of basically the soil's pantry, or the soil's freezer, wherever you store your food. And in the soil, that carbon molecule is stored in organic matter. So now that living creature goes to the soil's pantry, the organic matter, and consumes the carbon out of it. So now we have reduced organic matter in our soils.
And finally, Rick, what are you hoping farmers in southwest Wisconsin, of course, Iowa, Minnesota, and elsewhere, take away from the work you're doing there?
We like farmers, we like everybody, all are welcome to come and see what's going on. Even if you have nothing to do with agriculture, we all eat food. And we have to look at our agricultural systems as food production systems. So we like all to come. And when we have people come, we would like them to walk out there and look at it and go, this is very interesting. We would like them to say to themselves, I wonder how they did that. And if you choose to know more, you're welcome to get a hold of us. You can Google Fields of Cincinnati. We're on a website. It's quite current. You can get a hold of us. We'll give you a tour. You can come to our field days. Or if you just want to self-learn, just come, bring your shovel, put it in the soil, tip it over, listen to the soils, smell the soils, feel the soils. It's amazing what happens to the face of the earth when all these things take place, because the soils become soft like a carpet.
Rick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob. I very much appreciate the opportunity to talk about the Fields of Cincinnati.
That was Rick Bieber with the Fields of Cincinnati in Grant County. The Farmer-Led Learning Center has a new soil research project focusing on agricultural sustainability. Now we're turning to soil research in Vernon County, where we find Samer Karbush. He's the watershed planner for Vernon County Land and Water. Samer, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for your time.
And now your latest soil project, this partnership with the Bad Axe Watershed Stewards, that's a local watershed council. How did this research come about?
Yeah, so as a watershed planner, I work closely with the producer-led watershed groups in our county. I work with them as a liaison between our department, and they had some grant money that they wanted to spend on technology. They had asked me to do some research to try to figure out some good technology for them to use this money for. They ended up moving forward with these soil probes that measure moisture and temperature at three different depths along the probe. We have these spaced out around the watershed, the Bad Axe watershed, at different farmers' places. They're in various conservation practices and different sorts of tillage and different sorts of cover crops. So the goal is to measure these differences. This year, we will be having some test plots on a farmer's land that will have different cover crops within his corn. So we'll be able to see how these cover crops affect moisture and infiltration of water.
Now, Samrat, these soil probes, paint us a picture for somebody who hasn't worked with a soil probe, which I think is most of us. What do they look like?
Right. So it's just a kind of a, I don't know, I'd say inch and a half tube. It's 12 inches long, and it measures the moisture and temperature of three different sections along that probe. And it's completely self-contained. It's run off of a AA battery that lasts about 2 years. And I walk up to it with my phone. It's completely buried, and the Bluetooth picks it up, and I can download the data. We're taking a sample every 3 hours.
What is the value of having this kind of three hour by three hour information about our temperature and our moisture in the soil?
Right. So I guess, you know, after a rainfall event, it's nice to see how quickly the water is infiltrating, see if it is infiltrating. Different types of tillage, different types of cover crops, they will affect how quickly water will infiltrate into your soil and the temperature. And even one of our farmers is planting his corn in two different directions, you know, east to west and north to south. And that affects the temperature of the soil significantly. So this different data can help the farmer determine which way he would like to proceed in the future.
What kind of things can we learn, can we figure out about how to keep that soil on the land and not washing away into the water and the watershed you're protecting?
Yeah, as you mentioned, that's a big concern. Phosphorus and everything else travels into the water that way and down to the Gulf of Mexico and the Gulf of America. We should be keeping permanent cover on the land whenever possible. You know, a lot of times farmers are done, they're harvesting their corn and beans and whatever else, and they don't plant any cover crops. There's a lot of time where the ground is just exposed to the environment. And as we're having larger rain events, that's more important to keep cover crops on the ground, stuff like that, less minimal tillage.
And with that information in hand, what kind of practical changes can farmers in Vernon County make?
Yeah, so farming on the contour is a big one, and that would be, you know, farming perpendicular to the slope, and that means a big deal around here with the topography that we have in Vernon County. A lot of our fields are extremely steep, near streams and stuff, and the fields aren't super big, so farming on the contour, cover crops. Our department has money to fund that. We have dams. We're putting small farm ponds in on the edge of field boundaries in people's farm fields. And that's like a sediment control basin. They're not, you know, as effective as some of the bigger ones we have, but a lot of these small ones would be ineffective.
Are you getting a lot of buy-in from farmers in the community who want to participate in these practices to preserve their soil?
We are getting a lot of buy-in from farmers. And our goal is to, you know, get more and more every year. These watershed groups, these producer-led organizations are very helpful for spreading the word and getting information out to these farmers and giving them a chance to collaborate, you know, with other farmers and with agencies that are willing to support them, whether that's, you know, the Land and Water County, DNR, NRCS. There's all sorts of agencies that come together at these meetings, and it's very instrumental in spreading the good word and getting out what we need to.
You mentioned heavy rainfall events, and we can think of a handful in your neck of the woods over the last decade or two. Is that starting to change the way people think about preserving the watershed, preserving soil, avoiding the damage of flooding?
Yes, I think the floods of 2018, 2017, that time really, you know, struck a chord with a lot of people, and that is what everybody thinks about trying to prevent. I mean, there was insane washing through people's fields, you know, much infrastructure, bridges and other things were compromised, people's structures. You know, as we receive these larger rain events, I think people are more concerned with trying to keep the water on their land and keep it from reaching the streams and causing all this destruction that it can.
Well, that makes me wonder, is there a line from, you know, taking care of our soil better to flood prevention? Or am I overstating? Am I connecting dots that can't be directly connected?
No. I keeping the water on your land and making sure it's infiltrating as opposed to running off and then reaching the streams and causing these flooding issues is a great method of controlling that. I mean, if we're keeping cover crops and keeping land cover, a lot more of that water will infiltrate. The roots are, you know, making the soil more able to accept moisture. So it's a big difference when we're implementing these conservation practices on the landscape. That's instrumental in preventing these floods and keeping the water on the land.
Are you kind of always looking for more people, farmers and other community members, to get involved in their local watershed groups?
Oh, yes. Always looking for people. You don't necessarily have to own a bunch of land or be a big farmer. We collaborate with all sorts of different community members that assist us in the work that they're doing. So we've got somebody, you know, developing a website for us that's just a local member. So there's all sorts of ways to get involved.
So working with all these watershed groups, Samer, what are your top goals, top priorities over the course of this year?
Yes, so my top goals would probably be to get more and more people involved in these groups. I've been working to get farmers who aren't currently involved in the group, maybe larger players in the game as far as having more acres. So getting those people involved would have a greater effect on the work we're doing. We're working on some grazing grants to get experienced grazers. We're trying to work with them to promote grazing without necessarily making them sign a contract, but just a great mentorship opportunity for a grazer who has questions about their operation to work with the grazing specialist. That's one operation we're working on. And we're also working on grassland birds and helping people understand what types of the bird species use their pastures and how they can change their management too.
Samer, thanks for sharing your work with us. Thanks for joining us.
Yep, thank you.
That was Samer Carbush, watershed planner for Vernon County Land and Water, talking about soil research happening on farms throughout the county. Earlier, we heard about a new soil carbon project with Rick Bieber with the Fields of Sinsinawa in Grant County.
Coming up, the Weiss Earth Science Museum in Menasha faces an uncertain future as its host institution, the Fox Cities campus of UW-Oshkosh, prepares to close.
It is one of those places that almost every school kid goes to for a field trip at some point in their educational career.
The future of the state's official mineralogical museum, that's next on Wisconsin Today.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the new Bon Iver album, which is out today.
Wisconsin's Justin Vernon is one of the biggest musical artists to come out of the state in the past 20 years. For most of his career, most notably with Bon Iver, he has shied away from the media and chosen to quietly work out of his home studio, April Bass, near Eau Claire. But on his new record, Sable Fable, it's clear a lot has changed in his life. In a rare interview, Vernon talked with Wisconsin music reporter Justin Barney about the new record.
I think sadness is one of the easier emotions to access.
That is Justin Vernon, also known as Bon Iver, whose uncharacteristically happy album, Sable Fable, is out today.
I think I just feel a lot of feelings.
As a young man with a lot of emotion growing up in northern Wisconsin, Vernon sought connection. He went to the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, where he majored in religious studies.
When I studied like religion and stuff, I just was always curious of what made people connect. What made them feel connected to the spiritual, to the sacred things in being a human being. And so I think anguish and sadness was one of those things that connected people.
In the winter months of 2006, he went to a remote cabin in the woods. Isolated, he chopped wood, hunted deer, and wrote a masterpiece of an album for Emma forever ago. Come on, skinny love, just let's sing it. People really connected to his sadness. The cabin had this lore and created this mythology.
My dream growing up was just like, I'll just tour the Midwest and sell CDs out of the trunk of my Chevy Blazer or whatever, and I'll be happy. I'll have a wife and kids. And it just exploded to such a weird degree that still is very surprising to me sometimes. I don't think I'm like not talented or worthy or something, but like I generally sort of just was laughing about it. And like the second record was sort of me being like, whatever, like I'm free playing with house money.
And that money hit. The second album, self-titled, won two Grammys and solidified Vernon as indie rock's favorite sad boy.
After a while, this sort of thing that happens is like you're expected of it. It becomes part of your identity. Then it becomes your entire identity. Then it's really hard to shed it.
That's where this new album, Sable Fable, begins. Last year, Bon Iver released the first part of this album as an EP called Sable, which ends with this song, Awards Season. Vernon is often cryptic in his lyrics, which is why it's so great to have talked to him. In the first line, there is this figure, the Spaniard.
And the Spaniard, and song that I have banded to, is always handing me the anvil, saying that's for you.
The Spaniard, to me, it's the sad guy from Boots of Spanish Leather by Bob Dylan, like the saddest song of all time.
And yes, there's something you can send back to me. Spanish boots of Spanish leather.
And he's just sitting across from me and saying, like, here, keep being sad, homie. It'll turn out good. Maybe I got stuck on that sadness thing a little much.
But once the record changes from the EP Sable to the LP Fable, the whole vibe changes. It is joyous.
For once, we're having fun over here.
Justin Vernon fell in love.
A person came into my life and that changed everything. You see yourself in new light. You see the parts of yourself you've been working on, and suddenly it clicks, and they see you in a way that your old friends or family don't see you, and it gives you a new chance. There's a new chance there in that renewal. You know, you can live again. You can be remade.
A person that came into his life during this album is Danielle Heim, part of the indie pop trio Heim. Before making this album, a producer who was working with Danielle Heim asked Justin Vernon if he wanted to work with her.
And I was like, yeah, right now. Like, when can you guys come?
She came out to Vernon's April-based studio on 2/2/22. Being February in Wisconsin, they got snowed in. For 4 days, they couldn't leave the studio, so they started making this album.
Her, like, musicality, her drum feel, it's everything I don't have.
Heim and Vernon, they complete each other in a way.
She grew up listening to The Police and, like, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and, like, she has everything I don't got.
Together, they made this song. Though he's one of the biggest indie artists in the world and could live anywhere, Vernon has proudly remained in his hometown of Eau Claire his whole life. But with this record and these changes, he spent a lot of time in Los Angeles. He writes about that in the penultimate song on the record called There's a Rhythm.
It just tells the whole story of where I've been and where I'm headed.
I've had one home that I've known. Maybe it's the time to go.
When I was a kid, I was like, I love Eau Claire. I love it here. I never want to leave. This is who I am. Over the course of many, many years, and then the Bon Iver thing happening, it started to feel a little like I wasn't growing. I couldn't experience the town like my friends, or it was hard to meet new friends without anybody knowing who I was. And so going to Los Angeles and just being kind of more anonymous out there, you know, it's not like I'm a household name. It's been good because I think it's gotten me to disconnect with the identity. You don't have to hang around Wisconsin. Like, just because you love it doesn't mean you owe it something or that you should stay somewhere and not grow or not try new things. I think that's what that's all about. You know, it's about like taking a chance and stepping outside your comfort zone. And so it's made me deeply fall in love with Eau Claire again. I'm extremely privileged to be able to kind of go back and forth between this beautiful city of Los Angeles and then come back to my home. I think it's like the most I've ever loved Eau Claire is right now. This is home.
That was musician Justin Vernon talking with reporter Justin Barney about the new Bon Iver album, Sable Fable. To hear their full conversation, go to wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
The Weiss Earth Science Museum in Menasha faces an uncertain future as its host institution, the Fox Cities campus of UW-Oshkosh, is set to close in June.
This museum is unique in the state and in the country because of its focus on how Wisconsin's mining history has shaped the geological landscape.
25 years ago, then-Governor Tommy Thompson declared it the official Mineralogical Museum of Wisconsin.
Here to talk about the museum's legacy and its future is Beth Johnson, professor of geology at UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities. Beth, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
The UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities campus is set to close at the end of June. What will happen to the Weiss Earth Science Museum?
That is a really good question. Right now, everything is all very much up in the air. The people who have been working at the Weiss Museum are technically employees of UW-Oshkosh, and as of some notification letters that they recently received, their employment will be terminated with Oshkosh effective June 30th, which is the last day of the fiscal year. After that, you know, we don't know what's going to happen to them. We have been hoping that some other entity would be coming in to take over the instructional space for the university, which would help to keep the building open. And then that would allow both the Weiss Earth Science Museum and the Barlow Planetarium, which is right next to it, to keep operating. We have absolutely no idea what is going to happen to the museum at this moment.
It sounds like there's a major educational component with the museum. What connection does it have to the local community in Menasha and in the greater Fox Valley?
The Weiss Earth Science Museum is so important to the Fox Valley. It is one of those places that almost every school kid goes to for a field trip at some point in their educational career. But more importantly, it's one of the few places where people can go to learn about the geology of the state of Wisconsin. There are so many museums out there that will feature minerals, fossils, maybe some general aspects of geology. But the Weiss Museum is the only one that is dedicated to the geology of a single state, and it celebrates the geology of Wisconsin.
The late geologist Joanne Klusendorf, I want to turn our attention to her. She played a big role in establishing and developing the museum. What would you say was unique about her approach?
Oh, Joanne was totally dedicated to making geology accessible for all and making it follow a logical story. So if you were to go into the museum today, you would start the march through time. And it starts with the very earliest part of Wisconsin's geology, and it takes you forward through time. So you can see how the rocks have changed, how the fossils have changed. And then it blends from telling the geologic story to telling the human story. So you walk through a replica of the lead mine shafts, and then you see displays that are talking about mining history and how this influenced Wisconsin. And she was committed to helping people see the whole story rather than, oh, just this is just a pretty rock. She wanted you to know everything about that rock, how it formed, where it came from, what it represented, and how we use it in our everyday lives.
She was conveying her passion.
Oh my goodness, yes. She was very passionate about this.
Beth, how did this museum play a role in your own work as a geologist?
I came to what was then the University of Wisconsin Fox Valley campus in 2011. One of the first people to come down and welcome me was Joanne Klusendorf from the Weiss Museum. I mean, it was literally down the hall from my office. And she wanted to make sure that I knew of the museum's existence and that she wanted to be able to work with me and work with my students in order to make sure that I had all the professional opportunities that I needed for my job, and that the students had access to this museum. And it turned out after that meeting, we just also became really good friends. And she became the most wonderful supportive mentor that I could have had as I was navigating my way through those first few years and trying to get tenure and promotion at Fox.
Looking ahead at the Weiss, if it has to close, could its collections and its specimens be absorbed by another geology museum, say at UW-Madison or UW-Milwaukee?
That possibility exists. And to me, the most important things are to keep the collection together and keep them accessible. But the downside of at least taking it to the places that you gave as examples would be that it would no longer be in the Fox cities. Mm-hmm. So it would be inaccessible to the people here whose tax dollars have supported the building that it's in for so long. But more importantly, there are so few opportunities for students, you know, really in much of the country, but also in Wisconsin, to have access to a good education in the earth sciences. This would be one more barrier against that at a time when we need more people to not only kind of be exposed to this, but embrace it. We need to train more geologists because we have more jobs that are opening up due to retirement than we are training to replace them. And within about 10 years, we're going to be having a shortfall of about 130,000 geoscientists, according to the American Geosciences Institute.
Wow.
So we need more people to be exposed to this. We need more people to consider studying this or consider this for a career. But more importantly, it gives people a richer understanding of the world around them and some of the problems that we are facing in our society, where trained geoscientists can not only be a benefit, but a big help.
If you had a magic wand, what would you hope to see happen with the Weiss Museum?
Oh, God, if I had that kind of power, I would immediately wave it so that the campus was saved, because then I could, if nothing else, then I get to keep my lab. But I also get to keep the museum where it is, and I get to keep enjoying the access to the museum that I and my students have had for so long. If I could wave that magic wand, I would bring the students back. We used to have so many students that we had to rent space from a parking lot of a bowling alley next door because we needed space for people to park in. I would bring those students back, and I would make sure that the Weiss Museum not only had everything that they needed to be able to survive, but everything that they needed to thrive.
Yeah. Beth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Beth Johnson, geology professor at UW-Oshkosh Fox Cities. We've been talking about the history and impact of the Weiss Earth Science Museum in Menasha and what the future holds for the museum as the Fox Cities campus closes this summer. So we've got a fun conversation coming up with the author of the new book, Beer, Brats, and Cheese. She crisscrossed the state, 2,600-mile road trip here to uncover the best places in Wisconsin to get. Can you guess, Rob?
Just going with that title, I'm going to say beer, brats, and cheese.
Winner, 100% correct. And we want to hear from you. What's your favorite place in Wisconsin to get a brat or have a beer? And where do you go for the best cheese curds?
Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text. The number is 888-642-0232. Me, when the VFW down the street fires up their brat stand, I'm stopping by even if I'm not hungry.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Courtney Everett, and Rochelle Wilson. Our technical directors are Sarah Hopeful and Tyler Ditter. Tim Peterson is managing producer and Dean Knetter is our executive producer. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Thanks for listening to WPR News.